We came here from Idaho and via Oregon. I taught at University of Oregon for a year last year, and we're just really excited to join this community. And I'm, as you said, I'm the new associate professor of management for the School of Management, and my area will be strategy that I'll teach for the school. And we've got a lot of exciting things going on. I will tell you right now in advance that the courses that I'm teaching this fall all have prerequisites, so I can't get you into my class unless you're involved in the program. But we've got a lot of good offerings that we'd love to see people to come out and take in the program. And, it's just really exciting to be here in this community where there's just so much opportunity and so much exposure to all the kinds of things that I'm really interested in. I just came off of a two-day cultural retreat that was sponsored by the university and was a partnership between the K-12 school system and the university, and we had a really great experience. And you and I, just on the break, were talking about sustainability issues that we have a mutual interest in. I'm very interested in sustainability and bringing that part to our curriculum. Of course, we have program offerings in entrepreneurship and human resource management. There's really something for everyone. And our accounting program is really, really well-ranked and does a great job of placing students even in this local community. So we've got a lot to offer, and we'd love to see people either come back or start school here at UAS.
This may be an unfair question since you haven't actually taught out there. How many students are in the School of Business, do you know? Or a School of Management.
I don't have a good number for you for that. I am too new to really know that. I know that our classes are filling up well this year, which is great. Mm-hmm. And I think that means that we're looking at good enrollments. And, information about admissions and getting into the programs, really people should direct themselves to our website and make contact with those folks, because I'm kind of too new to really give that kind of information, and I surely don't want to say anything wrong. In terms of advising and in terms of just getting some feedback about how you might start or what you want to do with a college education, I'm really happy to field those kinds of questions for students. And you could come by and see me. I've got an office in Novotny now. I think I'm room 111 is my office number. Mm-hmm. And I'll be there Monday through Friday, and I'd be happy to talk to anyone that's interested in thinking about business for a major or even a double major. In this market, it's good to have some variety, and business is really always a good opportunity.
Heidi, when you introduced yourself, you said that we are happy to be here. You know, was that a royal we, or
no,
is there a family involved here?
No, that's not a royal we. I am here with my husband and our small son, who's 4, uh-huh. And I'll just be really honest and tell you that's part of why we chose Juno, is we just think this is a great community, and we really already feel welcome here and like we're a part of something really wonderful. It's got all the things that we love. We came from Oregon, but via Idaho, which is where we lived previously. I'm a Montana girl, and from Missoula, Montana. Very, very used to this kind of environment. It's a little rainier here than it is in Montana, but it's really beautiful and very similar outdoor life. And I guess I'll just add that we have 2 Newfoundlands, and so you may see us around town with our 2 great big black dogs walking around and really enjoying the great offerings of Juno.
So getting settled into the community a little bit. You said that you'd gone through a cultural retreat. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. We really focused on the special issues that concern having diverse groups in our courses, and not just the K-12 system, but also at the university level. And, I just really believe that the reason why I got into education is that I think ideas matter, and that education is the way that you get access to those ideas. I don't think it has to be a university system or a formal education system, but I do think that that is the way that you get access. And without access, there are issues about how you get the same opportunity that everyone has. And so we really focused on how we make our offerings useful to everyone and a broader spectrum, and really think about how people are affected differently, both by the institution of education and also by what they want and need from the classroom experience. I'm a huge fan of applied business learning, and I think that's kind of why I wound up in business. And I have a background in sociology, psychology, anthropology, even theology, but I wound up in business because it's really this focus on applied learning and the immediacy of being able to take that learning into an organizational environment and see the effects. And I love being a strategy professor for that reason, because we can look at real-world business problems or organizational challenges that you're facing and take them down, use our frameworks, and reconstruct our strategic intent to get the results that we're looking for. And particularly in this environment, that's really important.
When you teach a strategy class, who are your students typically?
They can be anyone from the student who's a traditional student who's come up from high school and gone straight into college, and this is their fourth year, and some of those students may not have any work experience even. And then recently I've taught in executive MBA programs, and so there we have students that have significant managerial experience. They're holding very high positions in organizations, and they're coming back usually to get that MBA and have that final professionalization. And I think that those, it can be all over the board. They all have something very unique to bring to the table, and it's really exciting to work with each group. You know, just in the moment that we think that strategy is an issue for people only at the very top of the organizations, we find startup companies from people, nowadays we have entrepreneurs that are younger than even the high school age, right, that are starting companies and making a big success of it, and they have the same strategic considerations of somebody that works at a major corporation.
You said applied business learning. Could you characterize what that is?
Yes. So for me, I really think it's this idea of, although I think there's nothing as useful as a good theory or practical as a good theory, it's really this idea of taking the knowledge that's been discerned from research and then bringing it into the world where we can see the application. And particularly in our field, or in my field in business, this application to the business decision making. And so just as an example, I'll teach an applied business research course for both MBAs and undergraduates this fall, and we'll look at real business problems that we can solve through the use of good data and data collection, both qualitative and quantitative, and analysis. And so it's really, for me, it's the ultimate of this critical thinking exercise of not just staying in that theoretical realm, but really seeing the action orientation of putting it into practice. You know, ultimately, that's what business study is about, is to put it into practice.
So this sounds like you're actually going to have to set up cooperative arrangements with local businesses in order to be able to make this course a success.
Boy, I would sure love to do that. I think that's great. I love this idea of asking organizations that have real needs and partnering students with those organizations. At some of the other institutions that I've been at over the years, we did this in a service learning environment, and the faculty member performed sort of a facilitative role as the partner or the liaison between these two, the organization and the student. And I think those are really great opportunities. But I'm also all about writing grant proposals and thinking about social issues that can be solved with business-oriented solutions. And certainly I'd love to be working with students on sustainability projects if there's interest in that as well.
Do you anticipate that you'll be able to get any of that kind of strategic cooperation going this early in the, because you're starting classes like in 2 weeks, right?
We are starting classes on the 30th, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the strategy class itself, we use a business simulation, which simulates the types of decisions you make in a large-scale public organization. And so that's kind of its own animal. In terms of the applied business research course, certainly I'm open to anything a student would bring as a reasonable suggestion of a project. So if a student comes with a client or an idea in hand, I'm happy to adapt to that and work with them. Matter of fact, I think I've got a couple students I'll be doing independent studies with that will be in that nature.
An independent study is?
Just an opportunity for the students to really do the course in a way that allows them to have the experience that they're looking for. Sometimes independent study is used when we have low enrollments, but that's just not the case for us this year. We have really good enrollment in our business courses, so we're really excited.
Heidi Knoll, new to the School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast, excited to be here in Juneau and exciting to talk to. Thank you so much for coming down and letting me introduce you to some of the folks on the radio community here.
Thank you so much, Pat. I really enjoyed being here.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 17th of August, 2012. It's the birthday of Jonathan Franzen, born Western Springs, Illinois, 1959, author of the novels Freedom and The Corrections, and most recently an essay collection, Farther Away. Jonathan Franzen, who said, "I come from a kind of old-fashioned Midwest, and I live in a techno-corporate, post-ironic, cool, late Eastern world. The two worlds hardly ever talk to each other, but they're completely, constantly talking to one another inside me. I have my parents talking to me in my head, and then other parts of myself talking back. I think this is potentially an interesting conversation." It's the birthday of the poet Ted Hughes, born in West Riding, Yorkshire, 1930. First collection came out in 1957, The Hawk in the Rain. Ted Hughes became known for his dramatic mythological themes, sometimes writing from the point of view of animals, especially crow. Married the poet Sylvia Plath in 1956, who committed suicide 7 years later. He administered her literary estate, didn't talk about her publicly until his collection of poems, Birthday Letters, came out in 1998. It's the birthday of the writer who said, "Between two evils, I like to pick the one I haven't tried before." Mae West, born Brooklyn, 1893. Davy Crockett, born on this day 1786 in Greene County, Tennessee, served 3 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives and was defeated by a lawyer named Andrew Huntsman, who had a peg leg. Davy Crockett said, "Since you have chosen to elect a man with a timber toe to succeed me, you may all go to hell and I will go to Texas." And he left the next day and was killed the following year at the Battle of the Alamo. It's the birthday of Sylvia Nasar, born in Bavaria, 1947, author of the book A Beautiful Mind, about a brilliant economist who struggled with severe mental illness. It's the birthday of the man who wrote an exposé about fast food restaurants, Eric Schlosser, New York City, 1959. The book was Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal, about disturbing practices in the fast food, factory farming, and meatpacking industries. Here's a poem for today by Ted Hughes entitled Perfect Light. There you are, in all your innocence, sitting among your daffodils, as in a picture posed as for the title, Innocence. Perfect light in your face lights it up like a daffodil. Like any one of those daffodils, it was to be your only April on earth among your daffodils. In your arms, like a teddy bear, your new son, only a few weeks into his innocence, mother and infant, as in the holy portrait, and beside you, laughing up at you, your daughter, barely 2, like a daffodil, you turn your face down to her, saying something, your words were lost in the camera. And the knowledge inside the hill on which you were sitting, a moated fort hill, bigger than your house, failed to reach the picture. While your next moment, coming towards you like an infantryman, returning slowly out of no man's land, bowed under something, never reached you, simply melted into the perfect light. Perfect Light, a poem by Ted Hughes from Birthday Letters, published by Ferris Strauss Giroux and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012 at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, edited by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 21 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. I have a bunch of guests in the studio with me who have all just come down off the glacier. They've been up in the Juneau ice fields for most of the summer. Annika Orr is here, Scott Braddock, and Jeff Kavanaugh, who's evidently in charge of the program. Jeff, I understand you're going to inform the public about what you've been doing all summer tonight in a public presentation, but we get a little preview now, right?
Yeah, that's great.
What have you been doing this summer?
We've been taking a load of students, 15 in all, across the Juneau ice field from Juneau to Atlin Lake in B.C. And during that time, they received lectures from world-class scientists. They performed their own research projects and learned a lot about living on the ice field, doing research in difficult conditions, and how science works.
So, Annika, you're a student at
Carleton College in Minnesota.
In Minnesota, uh-huh. But you're a Juneauite.
Yeah, I've grown up here my whole life.
Oh, okay. All right. And had you been up on the ice field before?
No, I've been up on the Minnehaha just from hiking to it. But it's pretty inaccessible if you don't aren't with a program.
Right,
this is my first time. Yeah.
Okay. And then, Scott, you're from the University of Maine, did you say?
Yeah, I'm originally from Connecticut, and I'm studying my master's at the University of Maine this fall.
Okay. And how did you two get involved in this program? How did you find out about it?
I was sitting studying for finals, and I looked pretty stressed out, so my professor dropped the pamphlet in front of me, and he knew I was going to look into glacial geology, and said, why don't you try this out over the summer?
Yeah, okay. And Annika, how'd you?
I've always known a little bit about it, just growing up in Juneau. My mom almost did it way back in the 70s, and some of my friends were looking into it, and I got really excited and applied.
How many students in all were in the program?
This year, 15.
15, yeah. Okay. And everyone survived?
Everyone survived. One didn't make it all the way across the ice field, had an injured leg.
Oh, okay.
But she's doing her research program from afar. She's working in New Jersey at her home.
Oh, okay.
So even after leaving the ice field, she's participating.
So did you have to airvac her out? Or?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, usually a normally scheduled flight to do so.
Right. Right. You were actually supplied by helicopter, I think, for a lot of the trip.
That's right.
I ran into some folks who were buying out Costco for the for the army that was up on the ice field.
Yeah, we startled a bunch of people with the shopping loans we ended up with. But students crossed the ice field on their own power. So they hiked up to Lemon Creek Glacier from the Home Depot parking lot.
Right.
Then down the Lemon Creek and across a couple of ridge lines and across the ice field on feet and skis. So the helicopters were not for students, they're for equipment.
Right. So how far did you go in a day, Annika?
It depends. Sometimes like 17 miles in a day, 20 miles. Other times it was just like a 6-10 mile day. It really varied.
And then who were the professors that came up on the ice and worked with you?
They were from all over, all over the world.
What kinds of subjects did they come in to talk about?
Glaciology, climate sciences. There was a lady from France who was into Arctic oceanography, all sorts of things. It was really neat.
And Scott, do you feel like, you said that you did this because of your interest in glaciology. Do you feel like this enhanced your learning?
Yeah, you don't get anything like this on the East Coast in the U.S. So I figured if I'm going to go to school for glacial and grad school, I might as well get on one. And like Jeff was saying, like some world-class lectures and then actually doing our own research projects and using the equipment and being out here. So
what kind of research did you do while you were in the?
I actually worked out great. I worked with a PhD student at the University of Maine, Seth Campbell, and we used ground penetrating radar. And we just tried to look at different features underneath the snow. And it really hasn't been done up in these glaciers. So
now, were you having to pack your own gear?
I packed my personal gear.
No, I mean the radar system.
I was hauled behind a snow machine.
Oh, okay.
And a sled, but it was all brought up here by Seth.
Right. So, Annika, what kind of research were you doing on that?
I traveled down to Paradise Valley with Jeff and some other scientists to kind of do an exploratory survey of the valley. It's like this 1 mile long valley, super vegetated in the middle of the ice field. And so that's pretty interesting because you don't find a lot of green in the middle of all the ice. So we were kind of investigating why, the history of the glacial history of the valley and potential, I don't know, stories of why it formed and what's going on.
You use the term survey. What does that entail?
So, we used a lot of different. There was a couple botanists with us. There was an entomologist looking at beetles. There was a lady who was looking at geomorphology, so looking at the different moraines and glacial features to try to figure out what was happening in the valley and using tree rings and lichen to piece together the story.
And what was your part in this?
I was kind of a all-around research assistant. Climb around, collect bugs.
Yeah, Annika covers a lot of ground very quickly, so she was the go-to person for all of the work.
Jeff, you're at the University of Alberta.
That's correct.
And was this a grant program that you instigated, or how did your involvement come about?
Well, this is a very long-running program. It was founded it's had various guises. It was originally founded in 1946 by Maynard Miller and others. And around the 60s, it really came into a focus of education and research. And I've known about it all of my career. I've had several colleagues go through it, and it's just been a constant thing in the back of my mind that it's a valuable program, mainly for science training, but also for research on the ice field. And I was done 2 summers of research up on in the first camp on Lemon Creek Glacier and overlapped these last 2 summers with JRP. And when I heard they were looking for a new director, it seemed like a great fit. It's a great program, and I'm very honored to be chosen to direct it in the next few years.
So you will come back and do this again?
Oh, very much so.
Are you starting to assemble the materials to get your team together?
Or? Yeah, we'll have a lot moving forward. I'm looking forward to a bit of relaxation after this summer. It's been an exciting and busy time, but we'll be preparing for next summer pretty quickly.
I should say everyone has a nice tan. and I noticed it's a reflected tan as well. It comes up from the bottom as well as down from the top. You all look like you've been in Hawaii for the summer.
Yeah, we feel a little guilty about that because we had a much nicer summer up there than most Junoites did down here. And I actually have some footage of the clouds leaving our site at Camp 10 above the Taku Glacier and heading towards Juneau proper. So we think we know where the clouds came from.
Well, thanks for sending them down. And we're really grateful down there on the ground. For
we do what we can.
Anyway, so when will the program restart? When will we see people, or when will people go up on the glacier next year?
The program generally starts with a week in Juneau, so some hikes to the Mendenhall and Herbert Glacier and some training. That starts the third week in June.
Mm-hmm.
And heading up again probably around the 27th, 28th of June next summer.
And then once you leave Juneau for the hike up, you're not back in until you arrive in Atlin.
That's correct. Students hiked out to Atlin on the 11th and 12th, and then we had a few days there, gave a presentation to the community there as well, similar to the one we're giving tonight, and then took the ferry around, and here we are.
Well, it must have been an interesting come down off of the hill. What was the first thing you did when you hit the ground? What was it that you wanted to do, or have you already done it? Have you made? Did you have the hamburger you've been hungering for?
Showered. Showered. It was a long time without a shower.
Nothing on there. Yeah. And so now, will you go back to Maine? Are you on your way back there?
Or? Yeah. So I fly back to Connecticut, and I got a week. Pack up and move out to Maine, and then I'll be there for 2 years doing my graduate work.
Oh, okay.
And then have a chance to go to Antarctica in January, too. So this will kind of get me ready for that, I think.
Yeah. Well, you're starting off your career with lots of the prereqs, I guess, for being a glacial scientist. So this is a really interesting program, and tonight everybody gets a chance to hear about it. Where will that be and when?
At 8 p.m. tonight, we're presenting the results of the student projects. Each student will present their results at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, and that's at 8 p.m. And I do want to say that if you can't make it tonight, please do visit our blog, which we maintain throughout the season and students posted regularly during the expedition. And that blog is at glacierchange.org.
Okay. So folks who were involved in the Juneau Icefield Research Program, our guests were Annika Ord, Scott Braddock, and Jeff Cavanaugh, who was the director of the program. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to hearing about the program tonight at 8 o'clock.
Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you.
3:33, tuned with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is a young man who has seen the world. Safran Hayes is here with me, and he's working on a documentary that will kind of tell the story of his trek across India, Nepal, and back to Alaska. Welcome, Safran.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure. So you said when we were talking before the show that you were putting this together in kind of like three parts, and the first part had to do with the urge to do this trip. Can you talk a little bit about that part of what set you off?
Yeah. I grew up here in Juneau, Alaska, and so I think a lot of local people would really connect with this story. And it starts off kind of in school here. You know, I graduated from JDHS, and it's kind of my conversation I had with a teacher, and that kind of inspired this desire to travel and to see the world.
So who was the teacher? I'm curious.
Psychology teacher. And, you know, and there was a career guidance teacher, and, you know, there's a bunch of teachers that have been really supportive. But, so I'm going to retell that story in the first act.
So when did you actually set off? When did you go?
Right after high school, the summer after I graduated, I went to India with a friend who was building an ashram. And for those of you that don't know what an ashram is, it's a kind of a spiritual, not really religious, but philosophical
building that brings community together to practice all different kinds of religions. And so I went there to help him build that, and then kind of went on my own trip north. And
now, when you left here to go help the guy with the ashram, had you made your plan? I mean, did you know you were going north from there, or did that happen as...
No, you know, of course I didn't tell I told my mother I was going to the ashram to help build the ashram. I didn't tell her I was going to go adventure north, and, you know, but I was, Surya was the guy I was helping build the ashram, and he told me his stories of when he was younger, and he had trekked through India and through Nepal and through Europe, and he helped just really inspire me to go and do it. And it's always been my dream to make this into a documentary, even before I went on the trip. So, and I thought that was a great way to do it.
So you had some kind of camera or
yes.
What were you using to film with?
I was using a digital
record with.
A Handycam, and it's a standard definition. And my final piece is going to be in high definition, so... a lot of this is kind of really exciting. Editing, I'm taking kind of the standard definition and making it into a mosaic and bringing it, fading it in and out through high definition film to kind of bring us back and forth through time to tell the story.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, so you finished helping your friend with the ashram, and
right.
He kind of showed you the way. You used the word trekking. Could you talk
yes.
about the difference between that and traveling? Is there,
sure.
is there a difference?
most Alaskans, most Junoites, we're very used to going out into the woods and bringing a backpack, you know, wearing our extra tufts, and just going out into the woods and being able to have a good time and living out of our backpack. And this is kind of a very Alaskan culture. and when I was trekking on the other side of the world, I took that with me. I took that kind of Juno culture of going into the woods, and I did that in India and Nepal. And so I had everything I needed was on my back. And when I went into Nepal, I had to take a train, I'd take a bus, I had to take a jeep, you know, and there's only one road, really, you know, really only one road into Nepal from India, and it is one of the most treacherous roads I've ever seen, going through the steepest mountains in the world, and we'd see buses that had fallen off the cliffs mm-hmm. and giant rocks in the middle of the road. And when I got off the bus, there's all these people that were trying to get me to go on their rickshaws to the hotels and things, and I really had to tell them, no, I'm trekking here, I'm hiking. And it was really difficult, but I managed to get away from the crowds and just go into the mountains. And it's probably dangerous, but I met some amazing people that way. And I got to stay with a local family there in Nepal, the Suratapa family. And it was just an amazing experience, kind of seeing how they live off the land in a sustainable manner. And, these are mud houses, just a metal roof with rocks on top, and they have a couple cows, and they use the cow manure to create gas, which then they fuel the stoves with, and they create electricity, and their whole house is self-sustaining. And it was just a really amazing experience to see that and to document that. And they're really happy to just let me be a part of their life for a week in Nepal.
Was the language a major problem?
With the younger generation, it's not. We're kind of, English is really becoming the global language. And so, being lucky that I was young as well, I really connected with the younger generation, and they loved speaking English with me as a way for them to practice. And so, The older people couldn't speak English, but they would get their children to talk to me.
So you kind of, it sounds like you sort of made the connection through what folks you were hanging out with. How did you meet a Nepalese that would let you come into their household?
Well, like I was saying, I started trekking into the mountains, and it was a really stormy night, you know, kind of what we're used to here, I guess. It was really rainy, but I just... ran into this, I was hiking up this road. I thought it was a road that would go to a city, but then it just kind of turned into this path, and I just kept going up it, and I ran into this guy that was walking up there too, and he looked at me really funny, and he's like, "What are you doing here?" You know, and I was like, "Well, you know, I'm trying to find where this road leads to in this town that is up here." And he said, "Well, there's not really a town up here, but you know, you probably shouldn't be walking out here in this dangerous weather. Why don't you come to my house?" And that was pretty much how I met them. And they took me in, and they fed me rice, and we had rice every single day I was there, and chicken, and so yeah, and they're just really fascinated, I guess, with why I was doing this trek, and they're really supportive of me making this documentary.
So when you explained this to them, you're probably talking through the fellow that you met on the trail that can speak English.
Correct.
And did they express, like, were they alarmed, or what was their reaction to doing this?
They're very confused at first, and they, and they're telling me, "You can't do this. There's snakes, there's tigers, there's evil insects. You know, you can't just walk around and not know what you're doing." And so they were really afraid for my safety. And then as I was getting there later, they started telling me kind of the political issues in Nepal, and it's very a lot of turmoil, and you know, the Maoist rebels can be very hostile towards white tourists, so they were very feared for me in that respect as well. And so I thought that was a really fascinating. And they had a really hard time explaining to me what the Maoist rebels were, and they kept referring to them as terrorists and things like this. And so I found that to be just really fascinating.
When you left this family then, where did you go next?
I went back to India, and I went to Kashmir. And, and Kashmir is another really rugged trek to get there. You can only get there by jeep, and it's very long road to get into Kashmir. There's only one road as well. And I went to Srinagar and stayed on Dal Lake, which is an amazing city of houseboats in the middle of a lake. And I actually got to stay there for a week, and I met a trekking guide who then took me 3,500 meters into the Himalayan mountains. And I documented the razor-sharp peaks and just the beauty of being in some of the highest mountains in the world.
Now, again, Kashmir is not exactly a political at-rest
yes.
country. You're kind of following the war zone along the edge.
Yes,
here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we did run into the military up in the mountains, and I filmed that. They were worried for my safety again, being near the border, the Pakistan border, and India have not been getting along for many years. But at the same time, they do support tourism and trekking, and so it was really kind of cool to meet the Nepalese army up in the mountains and get to talk with them and share my experiences, and.
So out of Kashmir to.
And then from Kashmir, I came. Well, the story's going to come back to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
I did more adventuring in Europe, but I really wanted to focus on India, Nepal, and Alaska. And coming back, I kind of got a little lost in my kind of this culture shock and kind of the title of the documentary. And I took off on another adventure here in Alaska, and I wanted to reenact that survival story of flipping a kayak and this surviving, getting back in the kayak, flipping it again, getting back in, flipping again, and just, the sea lions watching, and just this kind of, getting that amazing energy to pick the boat up and get it up on the shore, and survival of just what it takes to live out in the woods. And I won't give the ending away, but it's just it's a very psychological kind of documentary of my life.
What are your plans for release?
I'm hoping to get this finished by November if I can get the funds raised in time. if not, you know, next year sometime. but yeah, I've done most of the filming already, so, and, you know, it's been a project I've been working on for 8 years now, and I'm really excited to get it out there, and I really think that Alaskans will be able to connect with this story, and people from all over the world, really, and yeah.
Well, Safran, I wish you great success in your editing operations. I hope the thing comes together, and we'll look forward to a possible release sometime like in the first of the year, somewhere around in there.
If you're interested in learning more about this documentary, you can go to life2sustain.com.
Life2sustain.com. And
correct.
That's your blog or
that's the
webpage.
The documentary webpage. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much. A little Indian music to take us to our next guest. Music of India to kind of let our last guest clear the studio, a young man who's recently returned from trekking across India and Nepal, Safran Hayes, working on a documentary possibly released around the first of the year called Culture Shock, about his return to Alaska and some of the things that happened to him while he was on his tour around the world. My next three guests are touring around Alaska. I have three folks here who are the stars of Roustabout Circus, which will be playing Saturday at 3 p.m. in the Douglas Community Building. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I have Mary Morgan and Happenstance, who is Daniel Sloan in his, what is that, your Clark Kent guys?
Yeah, my clown name.
Okay. And the three of you put a circus together in a warehouse, basically, when you come to Juneau. A garage.
Yeah, well, yeah. We're going to be performing it in the firehouse on Douglas Island.
So how do you get the lions and tigers in that space?
You know, we couldn't bring them this time, unfortunately.
They wouldn't let them on the ferry.
Okay. So tell me about Roustabout Circus. This is kind of like a project from where you live? The community's big involved in this thing?
Well, we all started out with a community circus in Talkeetna just about 19 years ago. And it is still a community circus, the Greenlight Community Circus. And we, over the years, had a summer circus camp program every summer for the kids locally. The last, probably about 4 years ago,
we were able to expand the circus camp, which meant that we were able to hire more instructors, which could offer a lot more skills for the kids to learn. And in doing so, it meant there were, at that time, I think that first summer, there were 8 of us who started the first roustabout circus tour around the road system in Alaska. And then we have continued to do that every summer, usually working with the libraries in the state at their end of the summer reading program, celebrations and parties, or working through the arts councils, offering workshops with kids and then also presenting shows. Sometimes just dropping in on other communities and just showing up in a building and doing pass the hat shows, just throwing up a few posters and having all sorts of folks show up. It's been from loose to organized and everything in between.
Now, Morgan, you and Daniel came down last year and performed at the community building over in Douglas.
Yes, we had a great turnout last year. It was our first time coming to the Southeast, so we're really happy to be here again.
There's some YouTube footage, and the thing that was really cool that I loved was that the kids were talking to you while you were doing your show.
Yes.
It was like total interaction, and it was like, you know, like no circus act I'd ever watched in my life, because usually, you know, they're down there and you get to applaud and yell, but they were right in the act.
We love breaking that wall and having it, you know, it is not TV. You are not watching TV. We are real people up there to interact with, so
right.
That's very fun.
Yeah, and Daniel is carrying on a conversation with the kids in the front row at the same time that this is going. Now, you play clarinet while he does that wonderful thing with the orb, right?
Contact juggling, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And you're both jugglers as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And Mary, what's your role?
I'm a juggler also. I also rope a little bit. I'm also a clown. I also ride unicycle. I think we're all probably what would be called the circus generalist, a little bit of everything, so you can cover everything.
So, Daniel, how did you come into this business of being a juggler and a roustabout?
Well, I learned to juggle in college.
Talk right into that.
I learned to juggle in college, and I started performing in some little backyard circuses, only about a year after learning to juggle around Bellingham, Washington. And then I met Morgan at the Oregon Country Fair because we were both going on a circus tour called the New Old Time Chautauqua, which toured Alaska last year. And so we also toured with them up here in Alaska last year as well. And ever since then, Morgan and I have been creating juggling, clowning, acrobatic acts together and presenting them wherever we could.
So are the two of you living in Talkeetna now, or where's your base?
Well, we're living right here in Juneau but just because we're living and breathing here, we tend to travel most of the year, spending 2 or 3 months in different areas and different places.
Oh, okay. So on the road a lot. Are your shows usually as interactive as what I saw?
Yeah,
does
I would
the audience,
say so.
Kind of get right into the middle of what you're doing?
I would say so, yeah.
Yeah. And Mary, this thing started in Talkeetna. Were you like the inception of this operation? Do you have a background in circusing, or were you just sitting around one afternoon and said, gee, I'm bored?
there were probably a half dozen of us, kind of parental units in Talkeetna with children. There weren't very much offerings and things for them to do
right.
Year-round. And I've always been a circus aficionado ever since that little Walt Disney movie when I was like 4, Toby Tyler joins the circus. I don't know if you remember that, but that was the beginning of my fascination with the circus.
So rather than running off and joining the circus, you brought one to your
it
house.
It took a while, but yeah, I got around to it.
Yeah. And how did you learn to ride unicycle?
That I did when I was 12 years old. I just asked for one for a birthday present. And the juggling also was self-taught. And then when I was a kid, we went to some sort of resort that had the Florida State Circus, University Circus in residence there. And that was when I was really able to experience all facets of the American circus. And it was part of a camp for children, so we could do everything.
Yeah.
And then it became clear that, well, there was no reason why you can't join a circus, and if you can't join a circus, there's no reason why you can can't pretend you're doing circus, and if you pretend long enough, you are a circus.
This is what are folks going to see Saturday?
Saturday is going to be full of magic acts, juggling. We have some tap dancing, some acrobatics,
some clowning,
live music.
Lots of live music, indeed.
The layout's the same as what I've seen. The kids are going to be sitting on the floor right up to the edge of where you're actually performing.
Yep, and it's like, really for all ages.
It looked like if a club got away, it was going to go into the front room. But it's all safe.
Well, anyway. It's like if I fall, they're going to catch me.
Okay, and there's the real chance to actually come in contact with Moonshine, Happenstance, and family who are giving the show. So it's really a wonderful opportunity, I think, for Junoites to come in contact with the circus. I think that's really the best part of what you do. So is there any chance that you'd ever come here and do a school or something like that, or do?
Yeah, there is. We would love to come back and do some work, either a day or two workshops or even a whole week. We sometimes do week-long circus camps in some villages, so it would be really neat to do that here.
Someone needs to think this through and bring you back in to actually train us up some circus folks.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, this is kind of the folk music capital of Alaska down here, but adding circus to it would make a new dimension entirely. We have a huge dramatic community in town with Perseverance Theater
right.
and like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, Carol at the library is keeping her eyes open for a space for next summer where we can hang trapezes and silks and aerial rigging so that we can give people here in the community a really exciting go at testing their strength and pushing their limits.
Well, wonderful. Okay, so Moonshine, Happenstance, and Family, Roustabout Circus, Saturday, August 18th, 3 p.m., Douglas Community Building. Is there a charge for this thing?
No, it is free for the community.
Free for the community. Outstanding. So set aside Saturday afternoon at 3 and be sure you go to the circus, huh? On Monday, Jeff will have information about some CBG activities. City Manager Kim Kiefer is coming in. Philip Crowder will update everyone on upcoming Juno Dance Unlimited season, and he'll have Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more on Juno Afternoon on KTOO News. Weather update, tonight rain. It diminishes late, lows around 51, southeast winds 10 miles per hour, becoming light and variable late. Saturday, mostly cloudy. Saturday night, decreasing clouds. Sunday, partly cloudy. Rain does not appear Sunday. Sunday, partly cloudy night. Monday night, mostly cloudy. Monday night, clouds up again, and the rain comes back to us on Tuesday. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas, and we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can hear us on K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9 in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. You can hear KTOO on K210 AS. It's 89.9 megahertz. In Juneau, you can also get KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN is on 872, and KXLL is on 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org.